Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 556, Science Faction changing science and saving lives.
Changing science and saving. Are we converting to the metric system or perhaps the magic system?
What is the magic system?
Like, America currently has a very prestigious Western style of education. However, I have been an advocate for many years that, like, Britain, for example, has an incredible public magic school system, Hogwarts, etc.
Oh, I see.
I've been suggesting that we switch to the metric system. Also, start funding some of these magic schools for gifted people.
I mean, at the very least, you get some decent, like, stories out of it, which, I mean, all of the stories for our American education start and end the same. I went to college. It was really fun. I got drunk. Somebody sexually assaulted somebody else. We all had to come home early from spring break.
Yeah. God damn it. I miss college. Fuck, man. Real life sucks.
And speaking of missing college, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing back from the hot hellscape that is the place we both agree to be the hottest place on Earth,
Baghdad,
Phoenix, Arizona?
I did a secret government mission. Nick Fury came to me late after I recorded that, after on my vacation in Chile, Arizona. He came to me and he was like, Damian, we need you, and you're the only person who can handle the heat of Baghdad. Can you go? And I was like, ugh, fine. Long story short, Bin Laden's dead. The real Bin Laden.
So the best part is that anybody who knows you knows that that story's a lie. Not because Nick Fury's involved, not because a secret government mission is involved, not because Bin Laden was somehow alive and they picked you to kill him, but because of the simple fact that they decided that they needed to send somebody to a hot place and that they chose you, which we all know no government agency would ever choose Damian Mercado to send to a hot place. Damian, who starts sweating at about 64 degrees.
No, that was the thing. They sent me because... yeah, I am just going to be miserable and just lose gallons of water through body sweat. And I, by the way, for the fans out there, I'm not exaggerating when I say gallons.
Yeah, no, that's literal.
But the one advantage to that is that I'm very hard to restrain because I'm insanely slippery. So like zip ties don't work.
That's true.
You know, even masters of that weird Turkish oil wrestling, and I'm not saying that's native to the region, but they probably have a specialist there. Like, I'm going to out like slippery him. And some sort of like Captain America v. George St. Pierre fight.
There's actually an annual event in southern Georgia, a shitty state, not the shitty country, where they have a bunch of guys who are used to trying to catch a greased up pig try and catch a sweaty Damien who runs around.
Yeah, which sucks because I never want to go to Georgia. There's essentially some dudes. I just wake up, some dudes with a lot of body hair have tranquilized me. And I next thing I know, I'm being smuggled on a fucking cargo ship. To Georgia yearly, and they find new ways to get me every year.
And if you guys want to catch another episode of all of this great sweaty pig talk, go ahead and check out our I Call BS episodes, available only on our Patreon. Look up Robert Timothy on Patreon to check out our weekly I Call BS episode. By the way, amazing thing happened last week. Damian came as close as he has ever come to winning a game before. Really shitting the bed at the last minute.
You sack of crap. You know what? Go back and listen to the episode. Patreons. If you're not, then Bobby's just taunting you.
Yeah.
For no reason right now. But I did want to expand upon my sweating because I feel like some of the fans feel like we're exaggerating or something. No, Bobby, like, put your hand on a copy of, a chemistry textbook and swear upon it. When I say I am literally the sweatiest human being you will meet.
Easy.
I can say that with certainty. Everybody, and by the way, I say this, and like, by the way, here's how bad my sweating is. It is an impediment to my fucking comedy. There is no way that I step on a stage with, like, you know, the adrenaline of the moment, with the hot lights on you, that I just don't start sweating bullets. And even though it's a I'm doing a set that I've heard 1,000 times, I need to reference it for the audience. Otherwise, it's fucking weird that the guy on stage is just dripping in front of you.
You would be horrible as a criminal because, like, the second the cops got you into the interrogation room, it could be like a balmy 68 degrees and you'd be pouring sweat. They're like, we got him. We finally got the San Diego serial killer. And you're like, no, this is just a genetic condition.
No, I'm just really on fire with my jokes. I'm roasting this lieutenant and these lights are really hot. Listen here, you fucking high school dropout. You fucking Alabama Columbo. I'm not the murderer. I know I'm sweating bullets. I know. Okay, you know what? You stop listening. He's just beating me with a phone book now.
That and the fact that since you do sweat in any temperature that's really like slightly above freezing, you start sweating. Because of that, you're also a bad criminal because you are just going to leave DNA every place you go.
Oh, God. We've been out. Your wife, the first time she saw me sweating like this, was concerned. She was like, this isn't normal. This, and you just, you had to explain to her, like, this is, on anybody else, this would not be normal. I agree. If you saw me sweating like this, call 911.
Yeah, no, she was concerned. And no, I didn't even go into that much depth. I just casually turned to her because she's like, I think there's something wrong. I think something is wrong with him. Yeah, and I just turned and went, dude runs hot.
Yeah, I had to go like a fucking lizard and lay in front of the air conditioner for 30 minutes to recover from like a walk.
Dude runs hot. Oh, dear. Let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one, Plan S will change science.
S for sweat.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about. Just as they took the CRISPR technology from a bacteria to improve all of life on Earth, they will take my sweating gene to somehow create water. I don't know, weight loss?
I
don't know.
I do see you becoming basically like a Henrietta Lacks character where we basically harvest your sweating ability to somehow progress science future, like much further on than you could have ever done yourself. We figure out that that's the way to create like a special, maybe it's a rocket engine that uses sweat in order to better get to, so we can get to Mars or something.
We cannot seem to explain it, but we have discovered some form. Even he sweats on a molecular level. He creates moisture. It is, frankly, it defies the laws of physics as we know it. But on the other hand, he has created a source of disgusting water for all of the world.
No, you know what it is? It's going to be like SpaceX's next heat shield. It's like they use your skin cells to bioengineer a heat shield that sweats as it comes through the atmosphere.
It makes for much lighter spaceflight equipment.
Ironically, we actually know the person who designed SpaceX's heat shield. All right, so what is the main problem with science publication right now? In my opinion, there's a couple of problems, but the biggest one is the issue that many science publications, in fact, most of them, most of the prominent ones, are behind expensive paywalls, meaning the stuff that we talk about on this show, I can tell you a summary of it. You can go read like a Science News or a Science Daily version of it, but you can very rarely get the whole article yourself because you have to have a subscription to these different services or you have to pay per individual article you want to read. And that's a big problem because speaking as somebody who did their graduate work in public education of science, part of science is actually making this work public. So it's not just, hey, I have a hypothesis and I'm testing it, but publication becomes part of the scientific process because if you do it in your basement and never show it to somebody, that's not actually doing science because it has to be evaluated and be able to be seen by other people, built upon by other people, corrected by other people. Otherwise, you're just fucking around in your basement. And to some extent, that is what the scientific community has become, is a bunch of experts who can kind of pass information around amongst themselves and build off it in that sense, so it's not totally illegitimate, but it is not available to the general public. It's not even available to a lot of people who are outside their own specialty. And so if we don't find a way to take what is otherwise this weird ivory tower we have built where it's literally walled off from other people to be able to access, which is especially bad because a lot of that research is funded by the public, then we are going in a direction where we're kind of going away against the ethos of what science is, and we're certainly impeding future science. If you can't look up old research to decide what you want to research or what you want to build your graduate career on or something, then how are we going to make the scientists of the future who are going to make the important discoveries?
But Bobby, if we make science free, that's communism.
True, I guess.
We're a free country, Bobby, and freedom means having the freedom to pay for science articles.
Like, I'll tell you flat out, doing this show got difficult after I got out of my graduate program. While I was in my graduate program, like most graduate students, I could use my university access to look up scientific articles because they had subscription services to all the major scientific article providers. But once I got out, then it became harder. Then it became me just being able to read abstracts sometimes or having to look at only open access journals or publicly available science data. Whereas before, I had the plethora of basically any publication open, and there's a big difference, and that is a big deal. We should all be concerned about the fact that that knowledge is now being essentially segregated from a lot of the people who pay to fund it and who have a right to know about it.
So wait, you've been giving us second-class science for years and passing it off as the premium good stuff? Is that the headline here? Are you burying the lead, Bobby?
Yeah, I took the box of Fruity O's and I put the bag of it in the Fruit Loops box.
I know I haven't eaten an episode in a while, but I'm still dry heaving right now just thinking about all the second class science I've gotten.
Now, not only does this mean that you can't look up science articles yourself, which is a bad thing, but it means that those of us who are really invested in determining the authenticity and the reliability of scientific research have a hard time doing it ourselves. Again, a lot of my graduate work was in science communication to the public and in analyzing scientific articles, and part of that is looking at the math. And frankly, the math is never in the abstract. It's never in the publicly available data. If I want to go look up, you know, how somebody did a chi-squared test or an ANOVA test, and what the stats look like and what the original data looks like, if I want to go look up the data to any specific article and it's behind a paywall, I'm fucked, because that stuff is never being presented in the abstract. So if I want to redo somebody's math or look at their p-values or look at just, you know, did they do the right type of statistical analysis here, I'm not always able to do that if it's behind a paywall. That means that not only does that affect the public's understanding of science, it affects the ability of other people who are interested in this topic to kind of research and double check the scientific process that's going on.
Yeah, usually, I mean, I'd pay more to have that information restricted personally.
What?
If I'm reading an article, I don't want to see that shit. I just give me the. In fact, I stop at the abstract. That was one thing I learned because I also have a bachelor's of science as well as master's of business mastery, which is a real degree. And so I too am an academic. And let me just say, I'm not an expert in your field. Who am I to fucking sharpshoot you? Who am I? I'm just here to read the abstract.
Oh, dear God. So what are some possible solutions to this problem? And it's a big problem, by the way. Just so you guys know, I've talked about this before. Scientific publishing is a $60 billion a year industry. I learned this during one of the Nerd Night talks that were given at a Nerd Night that I host.
But Bobby, surely that couldn't be more than pornography.
Yeah, but as I pointed out at that Nerd Night, porn is only a $6 billion a year industry. And so scientific publishing is 10 times as profitable as porn, and that should tell us something given how much porn is used.
Question, though, Bobby, we're talking about porn now. I'd like to see, because porn had to have been much more profitable before it was free.
Yes, that's my point. Porn has become open access. Like, we figured out how to do it with porn. Why can't we do it with science?
Well, start making science less public and more pubic. Get people need to fight for, like, you need the public to want to crave science, for Baptist ministers to find scientific periodicals under their kids' bed that they're hiding next to their Playboys.
So what are some possible solutions? One is the use of open access journals. I use those a lot for this show. PubMed, Damien's favorite, PNAS.
Fuck yeah.
There's a lot of open access journals. There's even non-open access journals that have open access versions of them. So for instance, Nature, which is one of the most famous paid journals, has open access versions of it that it puts some of its stuff in. Those are some. Some are public licenses to paid journals, which I think should be a big thing. Meaning, like, I think the National Institute of Science should be able to pay some of these journals some fee, I mean, just like the universities do, and basically say, hey, for this amount of money every year, we want the general public to be able to access what's behind these paywalls. I actually think the next step to that, which I think is the real answer to all of this, is to essentially, Damien brought up communism earlier, is to essentially nationalize the journals. Now, I don't mean forcibly just take it from them, but like, I think it should be a public initiative where the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation essentially buys out the journals. They say like, hey, we are going to buy you guys out of your business. Now we own it and we are making it all publicly available.
And then we guillotine the people who have profited off of denying science win. Like later, I'm not married to the guillotine. It's a bit brutal. I'm firing wall. I'm cool with that.
Now, to be honest, right now, some of the ways around this are illegal, but they also, in my opinion, are one of those things that are moral but illegal.
Napster.
There's some Russian hackers who have basically put together like a dark web version of all of the major scientific journals where they have copied and pasted all of the papers that are on there. And if you know how to get to it, you can go read any journal that would otherwise be behind a paywall on these kind of illegal sites. And in a way, they're kind of like the Robin Hoods of information. Like they're stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. And I think it's kind of cool, actually.
So wait, they didn't respect the sheriff? Like they didn't back the badge? These Robin Hoods? I can't support that, Bobby. He's a law enforcement. He's a Leo.
So we mentioned at the beginning of this Plan S. What is Plan S? We've talked about this before on this show, but I'll give you a brief reminder. Basically, it's a big group of large and influential research funders. Some of these are actually European governments. Some of them are large private organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates organization. They are basically huge funders of scientific research and scientific grants that have got together and created what's called Plan S, which is to basically make all of the research that they fund publicly available. So if you are one of these organizations, you say, listen, we're going to give these grants out, but anybody we give a grant out to, any scientist we do, has to agree that any resulting papers from the money we give you have to be immediately free to read and published under a liberal license so that anybody can download it, anybody can reuse it, anybody can republish the paper, and the final paper has to either be in an open access journal, or if it goes into a regular journal like a Nature or something where it's going to be behind a paywall, that they keep rights to that paper and then also publish it in open access. So that's kind of like the hybrid model of, yes, you can publish it in the regular paid journal, but you also have to publish it in that. It's an amazing process. Now, this is somewhat controversial. There's a reason for that. The reasons being that the $60 billion a year that those organizations make are hotly defended.
My second yacht. I mean, like, really, we're just going to sit here and, like, let cancer be cured? I mean, at the expense of what? Honestly, I don't want to live in a fucking world where I can't have a second yacht. So let everybody fucking die of cancer.
This is kind of like the weird, seedy underbelly of science because, like, these paid journals, they have an ultimate monopoly. Because if you think of other monopolies, it's like somebody builds a widget and they're the only one who builds this widget. Well, the difference is if you look at some of these other ones, like Elsevier, which has Nature and a bunch of the other big stuff, they not only have all these journal articles, they have the past 100 years of these journal articles, and they're the only ones who have them. It doesn't exist anywhere else. And this is the known canon and the basis of all science. It is locked behind a paywall that only these people can unlock. It's the ultimate monopoly. And so when these people are angry and they want to fight back, they have a lot of power. To show you how much power, two or three years ago, they got into a big dispute with the University of California, which is one of the biggest university systems in the country, where basically the University of California had a deal with them. It was like $130 million a year. They paid this one journal, basically one large journal company, $130 million a year so that all of their students could have access to their materials. And they were like, nah, not enough. And they basically said, no, sorry, we're revoking your access. To the largest university system in the country, they have so much power and there's no other place to then get this information. And so to some extent, a lot of people, myself included, think that this has gone too far and like something needs to be done. Plan S is kind of the first answer to that. Now, it's not going to solve everything because, for one, Plan S is a small percentage of overall funding. It's only about 5%, though it is a bigger percentage of like esteemed papers. It's like closer to 12% of this funding have signed on to like these Plan S things. Basically, we need some bigger organizations like the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, big U.S. government granting agencies, the ones that really do a lot of big funding. They have to sign on to these stipulations, and they haven't yet. So that would be the first step. But the second is the one that I already brought up, which is, let's say tomorrow everybody goes Plan S. everybody says, if you want to do research, you have to publish open access. Fine. We still have 150 years of nature and science and discovery and all the big and cell and microbiology. We have 150 years of all the most important papers locked behind their paywalls. Even if we were to eliminate that starting tomorrow, we would still have to deal with that backlog, and we don't have a good way to deal with it right now.
You mentioned before, because this has been an issue we've talked about prior, but what if you've said, because a lot of this was done with public money, is there recourse in the courts?
No, because it doesn't matter. Like, there was no stipulation when they gave them the money that they had to do anything. That's the whole difference of Plan S. Plan S is basically a legal document that you sign when you agree to take money to do funding that says, I agree to make this publicly available. Before, it was like, hey, we just want you to do a research proposal on this thing in genetics, and then you would go do it and you could publish it wherever you wanted. And to be fair to the researchers, it's not like the researchers are bad. I mean, I just want to give you an example of what this looks like if you're a researcher who wants to publish. Yeah, sure, you can just publish in open access. But the problem is, if you're a researcher, especially if you're a prominent one, things like Nature and Science, the big journals, they are what is going to get you noticed at your university or your research institution. And if you want to publish with them, then either you publish the normal way, which goes behind their paywall, which is just basically you submitting your documents and you publish with them, or you can request that you publish open access to a place like Nature. And that fee to do that for a journal like Nature is about $12,000. Meaning, if you as a researcher want your research to be publicly available and publish in Nature, you have to pony up the price of a Kia to do so, which is crazy if you think about the research budgets that are involved in most of these things.
As scientists, I picture, you know, you're smart people. I'm surprised there hasn't been more of a movement against, you know, like, bowing to Lord Science and Nature. I mean, like, I'm kind of surprised there isn't more solidarity between the sciences. I get it. Everybody wants to publish in the big journal.
Yeah, honestly, the thing that I think the only way to really solve this is to buy out the journals, is to literally have a public fund that purchases these companies and then makes that publicly available. So from now on, Nature and Science and Discover and Cell and Microbiology and all those things are just open access journals, and that's the way it goes. And yes, Plan S is going to go a long way. I highly support Plan S. I think it's a great idea.
Make it a utility. You know, make science a utility. Fucking, like,
basically,
no. I don't want them to profit off it. I don't want them to be bought out. I want them to just all of a sudden, hey, now we have to stop fucking people and actually work for public good. God damn it.
Very, very neat. If you want to know how you can help, if you are going to publish yourself, you can publish in open access journals. I did that myself. You can cite using open access things, because the more we promote open access journals as being the new norm and the new standard, then the less kind of prominence that the old school journals will have, which is the only real advantage they have. Again, you can publish open access, and the only reason that's not the main way people publish is they want the prestige of papers like Nature and stuff. But me as a science journalist, I try and cover out of a lot of open access journals because I think that ups the prestige of papers that are inside them. And you as science reading citizens can use and cite those sources as well.
I have a suggestion. Okay, we have to Harvey Weinstein this. Harvey Weinstein used to be a name that meant something in Hollywood. It helped make
it mean
things.
Something still. I mean, yeah, okay. it's a different thing.
And right now, Nature, you know, they're the Harvey Weinstein. They're kind of this scumbag maker, kingmaker. Uh-huh. We just need the public to realize what fucking scumbag, how they've literally molested thousands of unsuspecting young science articles who just went out to just wanted to make a difference in Hollywood.
The problem is, you see, you want to go after Harvey Weinstein, right? But the fact is, Good Will Hunting is still a good movie, right? So, like, we don't want to throw Good Will Hunting out with the bathwater. Similarly, most of the super prominent stuff that's coming out are still going to go through Nature because that's such a flagship. And so while they may be doing some dirty deeds, we don't want to make it seem like the really good, really high-end science that's being published there somehow is tainted by that.
Well, listen, there are a lot of scientists who care a lot about their research, and we just... they're going to be casualties, yes. But that good science will still be published somewhere. It just won't be published at Weinstein Press.
All right, on to article number two. What's going on with the AstraZeneca clotting?
Yeah, what is going on? Because you told me not to be afraid, but then I go turn on the news, and it tells me to be afraid, Bobby.
That's a common thing with our show, isn't it?
Isn't it?
So we talked about the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine and the clotting issues that became a big deal in Europe a few weeks ago. Not so much here, because other than Damien's wife, who had to go out of her way to go get it, we didn't really have the vaccine available here.
She's recovering from her stroke nicely. Thanks for fucking caring, you piece of shit.
So what have we learned since we last talked about it? Now, we last talked about how there was some clotting instances. It seemed very, very small, but above the statistical norm. We weren't sure if that was real or not. The evidence when they brought it out seemed to say that it wasn't really much above the noise, signal to noise ratio, maybe a little bit in younger people, but wasn't really that big a deal. And you should probably just ignore it. They certainly shouldn't have stopped the vaccinations. Have we learned anything since then? Yes, we have. And we'll see if that changes what I would recommend that you do if you happen to have the ability to get that vaccine. So there does seem to be a very slight but statistically significant raise in a rare clotting disease associated with that particular vaccine. If you want to ask how rare, there are 222 suspected cases in 34 million individuals who have gotten the shot. Out of those 222, there are 30 possible deaths associated with the shot. So we think it actually has something to do with a rare immune response that is going on to a particular element within the vaccine, specifically one of the adenoviruses that they use in the actual vaccine makeup. Remember, this is not like the mRNA vaccines like the Moderna and Pfizer. This one's an adenovirus vaccine, which means that it is essentially like a cold virus, an inactivated form of a cold virus where somebody smacked the spike protein on top of it. We give it to you. Your body learns how to attack the spike protein. So the clotting disease appears to mimic something we've seen before, which is a clotting disorder that can be brought on by a drug called heparin, in which certain people clot in response to that drug. What we think is actually happening is the adenovirus, which is engineered to have that spike protein on it, it basically gets like maybe broken up a little bit inside of your body, the DNA for that adenovirus. And like heparin, DNA is negatively charged, which we think would allow it to bind in very specific people in a very specific set of circumstances to a part called PF4. That then triggers antibodies. And the immune system's already on high alert because it's got a vaccine in there, and it basically overreacts, causing a clot, and that is what's going on in certain people. Now, again, this is incredibly rare. We are talking possibly 30 deaths within 34 million people who are given it. That is literally less than a 1 in a million shot. I want to remind you that even in very, very good cases, our death rate with COVID is something like 1 in 50 people, sometimes much higher depending on your age group and stuff like that. So think of the difference of 1 in 50 versus 1 in a million, and the math kind of does itself there.
Don't European populations have stronger immune systems and immune responses to, you know, you have higher instances of people just being naturally resistant to HIV or whatever?
HIV, yes, has to do with a very interesting quirk in very specific groups in Northern Europe that have happened to have some higher levels of HIV immunity. But that doesn't have to do with their immune system. That actually has to do with the binding sites of specific T cells.
Well, I know Europe is a first world nation. I know that for a lot of their history, they were selected for because of how fucking just dirty and grody they were.
Yeah, that's true.
So I just assumed that perhaps people in Europe had perhaps more active immune systems. But if we gave the AstraZeneca vaccine domestically here or in China, would it have the same reactions?
I mean, likely. We don't really necessarily know about population genetics. We're not sure how that would work out. But what we can say is what we're seeing is really a blip on the radar screen. Some countries are still suggesting to reduce its use among younger people, given the idea that younger people don't have as nearly as much risk for COVID. And so the increased risk of clotting is a bigger deal for them. Whereas with older people, you know, again, especially with older people where your mortality rate is closer to like, I think it's like 1 in 20 or something. It's like 1 in 20 versus 1 in a million. Again, you don't need to be a mathematician to figure that one out. Let's figure out what our odds are. But frankly, I wouldn't be worried about this. The 1 in a million thing is not something that I am going to flip out about. I already got my vaccines, my Pfizer. And if somebody was walking around with a needle that had the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, they're like, hey, this is about to go bad. I'd be like, put it in my arm. I already got one, but I want a refresher and I don't care. The risk is so low. Give it to me anyway, because I just want to, I want my body to get another look at a different version so that I can keep fighting this stuff off. It is such a small thing. Another thing to remember is this is going on. We're not 100% sure of the mechanism. I mentioned one possible mechanism with it binding to the DNA and stuff, partial fragments of the DNA. It could very well be that this is, you know, maybe has to do something with the spike protein, in which case it might be the case that the same people who find this very, very rare, less than 1 in a million, that have a clotting disorder when they get this particular vaccine might also get a clotting disorder when they get COVID. I mean, those are much more common, clotting disorders and COVID. And so it might be one of those things where it's like, yeah, this person, because of their genetics, they were going to die either way. So might as well give them a much better chance with the vaccine than with the disease itself. So yes, there is certainly a tiny, tiny, but statistically significant increased chance of clotting and increased chance of death with those. It is so much lower than the chance of death from COVID itself and from everything else, and from your, by the way, your chance to give COVID to other people. And it's hard to hear if you happen to be like the mother of one of those people, those 30 people who died, but we should absolutely keep distributing this vaccine. If you have the ability to get this vaccine, you absolutely should go get this vaccine, and you should not be scared by these tiny, minuscule numbers. I just want to kind of remind you guys of something we talked about before, because this is kind of something you have to think about when you think of stats and science. Damien, do you remember we've talked about this a few times, about how every once in a while, drunk driving car accidents save lives?
Yes. Every once in a while, you will get into an accident with a car at a stop sign, and hence will not kill somebody on the freeway.
Well, no, it's not
when you get home.
Yeah, yeah, it's that one. It's like, okay, so if the difference is, it's not like you'll get onto it on the freeway because you'll die. It's okay, sometimes driving home drunk and getting into an accident, as opposed to like you're drunk and you take an Uber, actually saves lives. And a lot of it's because, like you just mentioned, there's domestic violence, right? So if that drunk person makes it home, sometimes they'll end up killing their wife. Whereas if they get into a DUI crash and just break their leg and the ambulance comes, then nobody dies. Some of it is literally because there is a certain amount of deaths per mile driven, even when you're sober. So you call the Uber and you get in that Uber and that Uber driver's dead sober, he still has some chance of crashing. And if you live 10 miles away, you have 10 miles for that chance to occur. Whereas if you get into a DUI crash 30 yards down the road from the bar, you have not had the chance to die if it's a non-fatal DUI crash for those 10 miles. So like, there are weird stats where when you look at it, drunk driving, technically speaking, actually saves a certain number of lives every year. It does not mean that you should drive drunk.
Yeah, you sound like my arresting officer, and I'm going to repeat what I said. Listen, officer, I'm saving lives because I will go home and kill somebody. And then he just added more charges. He wasn't willing to hear the science behind what I had to say at all.
So anyway, keep that in mind when you're thinking about these numbers. And please, if you get a chance, go out, get that vaccine. Thankfully, here in the U.S., we are in California. I think we've just crossed the threshold, or no, we crossed the threshold in 3 days, I believe, over which everybody over the age of 18 will be eligible for the shot. And that's supposed to be go on for the rest of this country pretty soon. So if you can get it, get it. It's not just about you. It's about stopping a chain of transmission and saving lives down the road.
And if you're listening to this show and for some fucking reason, because you thought it was a different podcast, a Joe Rogan podcast, just take the vaccine to trigger the libs. We fucking, Bobby and I, we hate it when strong, red-blooded, gun-loving Americans get the vaccine. It triggers me. I don't sleep for days.
Oh, dear. Thank you so much for coming back for Science Faction 556, where you learned all about the problem in publishing and how even if it does cause clotting, the vaccine is still safe. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 557.
Listen, officer, have I been drinking? Absolutely. Was I about to go home and beat my domestic partner? Fuck yeah. But yeah, I see your point. I need to go to jail.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.